What's going on, everybody? Welcome to CCO's The Science of Fishing. We have a really special episode today with Kimmy Werner. She's a great gal. She's out in Hawaii right now, so she's joining us via Zoom, and we're going to get into a lot of cool stuff.
You've landed on CCO's The Science of Fishing, where passion meets precision. Hold on tight as we dive in. But before we do, we would like to thank Sea Mule and Black Reef Co. for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, Kimmy, how you doing?
Hi, I'm doing great.
Great, great. Thanks for joining us on the show today. You know, you're an awesome woman from what we can tell. We've seen you in a lot of different things from all over TV, Steve Rinella and all that stuff that you've done. And, you know, you're an inspiration to a lot of different people out there. And I want to just, you know, spread the word about what you do, what you got going on. And, you know, would love to kind of talk about you. And let's start from the beginning. Let's start from where you came from, you know, and how you grew up and how you got into spearfishing and all that you do right now.
Sure. I was born and raised on the island of Maui, and I got my introduction to spearfishing because it's something that my dad used to do when I was really young. When I was pretty much like from 6 years old, younger, my parents were pretty poor at that time. And so it was my dad's way of feeding us, is he would go out free diving and spearfishing to literally put food on the table. And he always jokes that he couldn't afford to hire a babysitter. And so I got to tag along with him when I was about 5 years old. And just being introduced to that underwater world was just absolutely mesmerizing. And it was just such a cool experience to watch my dad dive down and get my dinners and to be totally immersed in this beautiful world. Shortly after that, my parents started making money. And so we no longer really had to do that in order to put food on the table. And so it was something that I kind of ended up missing my whole life. I just remembered those really early days of getting our food that way. And it kind of was just something that felt like it was like calling me or haunting me like my whole life. And it wasn't until I was all grown up and 24 years old and living on a different island in Hawaii, living on Oahu, that I finally realized, like, I've been thinking about these underwater memories of watching my dad spearfish my whole life. And I need to stop just thinking about it, and I need to like go try myself. Yeah. And there weren't like a lot of women spearfishing for sure. And I didn't really know a lot of spearfishers at the time. It wasn't like as big as it is now. But I got a three-pronged spear and just started to go out on my own and literally poke around and try. And when I finally was able to get my first meal out of it, it was probably the most gratifying sense of satisfaction I ever felt. And it, that day just changed my life completely.
Were you doing it then, you know, when you shot that first fish, what did it feel like? Like, did it feel like you were a little kid again? Bring back memories?
It definitely brought back memories. I went through a whole roller coaster, to tell you the truth, of emotions that day, because I really didn't know what I was doing, and yeah. I didn't have mentors at the time. You know, I didn't have my dad living there. He wasn't really doing it anymore anyway, but we're on separate islands. But I got a spear. I like had surf shorts, bodyboarding fins, and a rash guard. And I went to this beach on the North Shore, and I was just like determined to go out and just try. That was my goal of the day. Like, stop thinking about this and just go try. And the minute I like remember opening the door and stepping out of the vehicle with the spear in my hand and knowing I'd have to walk across the beach in front of all these people, I really felt anxious. I really felt insecure. I really felt anxiety. Like, I felt like, oh my God, everyone's gonna look at me, because it was kind of an odd thing to see a girl with a spear at that time. And I just thought, like, everyone is gonna know I have no idea what I'm doing. And I remember trying to hide my spear and kind of like creep past everybody, and was thought, as soon as I get in the ocean, then everything will be okay and all these feelings of anxiety will go away. And instead I got in the ocean and the anxiety just kicked it up a notch, because I didn't know what I was doing. And it wasn't the best day to go out diving. It was actually kind of murky, pretty windy. And it just really made it hit, like, you have no idea what you're doing. And so I kept swimming and swimming. I was pretty paranoid, always trying to look over my shoulder, like, you know, getting a little spooked out by things. It just wasn't the best day to be out there, to be honest. And finally, after swimming for maybe like half an hour, which felt like an eternity, I was ready to just like give up and go back in and call the whole thing a stupid idea. But right when I was about to do that, it was interesting because it was so windy, there was this chalk, these white caps, this wind swell, and a little wave, a little, you know, wind chop broke. And when it broke underwater on the surface, I saw bubbles. And as soon as I saw bubbles, my whole body went calm. And what happened is that it triggered a memory of childhood, because my only job as a 5-year-old and 6-year-old following my dad around was to keep up with him. I didn't spear anything. I just got to tag along. And there were definite times where I would get so intrigued by something I saw, you know, when I was looking down a turtle or something, that I'd spend some time looking at it. Then I'd look up and my dad would be nowhere. And I'd feel really, really scared and small. But I'd have to like really look at the edge of my visibility at the surface and look in all directions. And as soon as I saw the bubbles left by his fins as he swam, if I could make out the bubbles left by his fins, I just knew, there's dad, go that way. And I would be able to catch up with him. And so that day, as a 24-year-old woman, as soon as I saw bubbles, it triggered that memory. It actually triggered that response of, there's dad, you're fine, everything's safe. And wow. And even though that wasn't really the reality, I kind of just used that to my advantage to get that calm feeling. And so it sounds so funny, but I really just started looking for bubbles and looking for the wind swell breaking to make myself feel safe and feel calm and stop panicking inside. And with that, I just kept swimming. And then I even started like kind of squinting my eyes and trying to imagine my dad's silhouette and remember that memory. And that made me feel calmer. And it kept me swimming just enough until I was actually able to find this little patch of reef, probably in about 25 feet of water. And through trial and error, I just, you know, went down, started looking under rocks and just started trying to spear these little fry fish. And they're all fish that I knew by heart. And these are the fish that I grew up eating, that my dad would bring home, that I would help my mom clean and cook. And so that part started to feel really familiar. And I just tried to remember what I would see my dad do. And yeah, when I hit that first fish and actually got it, like, I mean, it's only like 5 or 6 inches big, but it just felt like, I mean, it just felt like I won the greatest award of my life. You really? Know, it was just such a true sense of victory when I finally had that in my hands. And by the time I came in, I had about 5 or 6 of these fish. And I always like describe that as the day that changed my life. And one thing that I really know is that the woman who entered the water was a totally different woman than the one that came out of the water, because I no longer felt embarrassed to walk up the beach holding a spear. You know, I had my fish, I had my spear. I wasn't trying to hide myself. I wanted everyone to see me because I felt proud of myself. And I felt like a lioness who just secured this catch. And when I took it home that night and cooked it for my roommates, it was like the most simple but delicious meal ever. And that day was just like, it was like the feeling of falling in love. It was like nothing was the same after that. Yeah. I went to work the next day walking on clouds. I was living in my head just thinking about how good that felt. And I just knew like, this is what I need to do for the rest of my life.
Yeah. So at that time, were you already a chef, or were you still getting into the culinary arts, or what was going on?
I had graduated with a culinary degree. And I was working in a restaurant.
Okay. So you were able to prepare those dishes delicious. You knew exactly what to do. And
yeah, but to tell you the truth, none of that knowledge really came from my culinary education. It just came from like the most simple, like home cooked style that my mom did at home. And that was also what was so shocking to me. It's like I kind of went on this whole journey of becoming educated, learning skills, you working in restaurants, studying different cuisines, you know, fine dining, all this stuff. And then when I just pretty much took home, you know, fish and scaled and cooked them whole with some salt and pepper, it was like, when it's that good, you don't need to really just stay out of the way of it. You know, you don't need to do much. And so that was also an eye-opening, like, culinary thing for me, was to realize, You don't have to overdo it when the ingredients are good. You don't have to be a professional chef when the ingredients are good.
Right, right. So now when you're shooting fish and you're, you know, diving all around Hawaii and checking all that out, is the mindset still the same? You know, are you still looking for those bubbles, or are you, you know, kind of now, how has your mindset developed, rather, is the question that I'm trying to ask, from then till now?
Well, I mean, I think since then, you know, that was almost 20 years ago. Wow. And that day was almost 20 years ago. And so since then, I feel like I've almost lived like this entire other lifetime of my own diving, and I've gotten to travel the whole world because of it. You know, I've gotten to dive in Africa and Mexico and Panama and the Arctic and Antarctica and Japan, like all over. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is I think like those same feelings would emerge whenever I entered new waters and new oceans, because gradually I got better and better, you know, and kept diving in Hawaii. And then I had my first time ever diving outside of Hawaii, and that was at Rhode Island in the United States National Championships in 2004. And man, fear kicked in then because I could barely even see my fins. It was cold water. I was wearing a thicker wetsuit. At first, I had a hard time even like making it down to the bottom because I was so freaked out, because I was just going through these layers of darkness. And I kept thinking I saw the bottom, then I go right through the bottom. And, I ended up like being able to push past those discomforts. Actually, that Rhode Island trip, I became the national champion. And it really just taught me something, that I will get scared and I will get anxiety, and that will continue to happen. And that's not a bad thing, you know? And especially anytime you're taken out of your own comfort zone and you're plopped into another place and now there's killer whales and it's dark or whatever it is, you know, you should feel scared. You should feel anxious. You should feel anxiety. That's called stress, right? And I think what I've learned is that so many times we try to run from our stress and we try and deny our stress, and then the stress comes back harder and harder, and then it can turn into a full-blown panic. And to me, there's a very big difference between stress and panic. And stress is something that I still feel all the time, but I just welcome it in a different way. Panic is something that I never want to do, because I don't believe that good comes out of panicking. Good can come out of stress. I'd rather have a certain level of stress and focus then I would be completely complacent and negligent. Everything's fine, you know, don't worry about it. Like, no, I don't think that's the right way to take it. I like to have a certain level of stress if I know how to harness that stress and turn it into courageous assessment and efficient action, and calm. I can also take that stress and turn it in to this like calm, serene, like flow state. But if I ever react to that stress by panicking, like that's the last thing I want to do. And so I don't know if I answered your question, but I guess like that is something that I don't necessarily have to imagine bubbles or make up like scenarios that my dad's there anymore, because I think now I have a better understanding of what my brain is doing. I have a better understanding and confidence in my own abilities. And I also just have had a better understanding of stress and panic and how to choose one over the other. So I don't have to make up bubbles. I can just normally feel the stress, say, okay, that's a good thing. And actually it is a good thing. Like most of my favorite memories are when everything is so heightened because of a certain amount of stress and adrenaline running through my body. And then I turn it into like thrill, awareness, you know, like awareness of my situation and just responses. And when you're able to do that, oh my God, it's kind of like the best combination of feelings ever.
Yeah.
If you were to take the stress out of it, it would not be nearly as fun.
Yeah. You need the stress. You need the adrenaline while you're diving. I feel like to, you know, be laser focused, hyper focused in there when you're, whether it's blue water diving or reef diving, right? You know, have you ever been in a situation where you've been in a panic, and what have you done, you know, to overcome those types of situations?
I mean, I used to panic when I would, like when a shark would come and like steal a fish off my float. And what I mean by panic is like not totally hyperventilate and freak out, but just I would swim away. I would back up, you know, I would try to get away from the shark, even if I like ditched my float and like just got away from it. And then eventually slowly creep in and make sure it was gone and all my fish would be gone. And then like be super scared the whole swim in. And that's not too bad. That's not a horrible response, but it's also not the most efficient response. And I think, you know, I think it's all those moments though that then kind of led me to get more and more comfortable and realize, okay, when a shark comes in to steal your fish, like if you can, and usually you can, like defend your catch, you know, like if a shark is swimming at you, you should be swimming at that shark. Like you should not be swimming away from it.
When you're fighting a bear, you gotta just like yell at it. You gotta swim at the shark type of thing.
Totally. And I find it's just about matching the energy. Like if a shark comes in and it's so calm, I'm not going to just swim at it and be aggressive. Like, no, I'm just going to be calm and match its energy. But if a shark comes in and it's acting aggressive, then I most definitely am going to try and match that energy.
Right.
And I think like, yeah, I think that it is failed forms of panic that have led me there, because I learned that, okay, if I just do the opposite and get really scared and back away, number one, I'm not going to have any fish. And number two, sometimes then that shark just starts acting like a big bully to me, you know? Whereas if I just like do what I can to protect myself, protect my catch, and not act like prey to this shark, but act like a fellow predator, it usually leaves me with my catch intact and also with the shark wanting nothing to do with me.
Right. That makes
you know,
sense.
And it's never like a formula that's going to work all the time. I'm never going to be a person who says that, oh, sharks are fine, just do this and you'll be okay. They're wild animals. Anything can go wrong. I'm just saying that I have noticed in all of my time of diving that holding your ground definitely for the most part works out in your favor a lot better than squirreling away.
Right. Is in Hawaii, is there a big shark problem like there is here in South Florida, or is it much better managed over there?
No, we definitely have a lot of sharks, but we don't. And so, yeah. So, you know, again, I've never dove in Florida. And so I might dive there and totally be like, oh, over here is different. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I definitely have gone diving with a lot of aggressive, you know, with a lot of aggressive Galapagos sharks, tiger sharks, been in the water with great white sharks, like oceanic white tips.
Are you scared of those sharks? That's a lot. Those are some big sharks, great whites and all that.
Yeah. And, I mean, I definitely feel fear, you know, but like I said, it's just about like, oh, I feel fear every time, you know, I don't think I ever want to not feel fear because then you become complacent, but it's just about holding that fear and harnessing it and then turning it into something more useful.
Right.
Which is usually courage.
Right. That makes sense. So when you're out there, have you, you said you've swam with killer whales, right? What kind of experience is that?
I have.
That's probably crazy, right? Like that's something nuts. Not a lot of people get to say they've done that.
Yeah, that was insane. That was actually, I was way more terrified of the thought of that than I was sharks at that time. But I think because I was kind of terrified of it, this is like an experience I actually did. I mean, I was invited on this trip to go be in the water with killer whales in Norway. And it was cold, but, it was Norway in the winter time. And so at first, you know, I just kind of wanted to face this fear. And so we would see a pod of killer whales coming. We would just kind of slip in the water at first and we would just kind of watch them pass us by and they didn't really pay us much attention. They would just pass underneath us. And it was kind of just like, at first I'm like, okay, this isn't so bad. This is like watching, I mean, they are technically a type of dolphin actually. So it felt like similar to watching this really big dolphins with really big teeth, but like swim underneath you. Eventually I was able to take some drops down and just get a closer look at them and they would check me out. And I was like, oh, they're kind of, no wonder they are dolphins because they are acting like dolphins. And it started to seem less and less scary and I started to get more comfortable with it. But then this one day we did the same thing and we saw this pod of killer whales coming. So we slipped in the water ahead of them and we jumped in and they never showed up. And so I kind of was like, oh, maybe they sensed our presence in the front and they, you know, redirected and are avoiding us. And I kind of was just thinking, oh, I hope we're not bothering them. I was thinking things like that. And right then I put my head out of the water and a little ways in the distance, I just saw this, this bird pile, you know, forming in the sky, starting to circle, which, you know, we all know means something's going to start happening underwater. Yep. And then I just saw these birds start to dive and dive and dive. And I was like, wow, you know, and then I just saw in the distance these huge dorsal fins like, and just like flashing across the water. And so it was very clear that a bait ball had formed. That's why the birds were diving down and eating the bait. The orcas were like, you know, driving these fish to the surface and just like demolishing them. And I watched it happily from afar, like, wow, look at that. That's amazing. You know, look at that nature, look at that ecosystem. And all of a sudden I just saw the whole bird pile start to come my way and oh my come goodness. My way. And I'm still in the water and I'm just like, and it just happened so fast. And before I knew it, all I could see was just black and white blurs, just right in front of my, it was like blurs. It was like, they were so fast. I couldn't see them and the water around me was moving so fast and I was right in the middle of orcas hunting herring. And
wow.
And that was intense and that was gnarly. And then everything just went dead quiet. And then the birds all kind of returned to the sky. And I was just like shaking and there were just scales, like the whole water just looked like glitter and there were scales, but it was like almost just like eerie how quiet it was. And where did these killer whales go? Where did these orcas go? Like, how did they come so fast? And somehow they didn't hit me, you know, they're all around me hunting, but didn't bang into me and now they're gone. And I looked down into the dark waters and I just saw one singular bubble coming up coming up right underneath me is one bubble, and this bubble got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then right in front of me, right on the surface, it just popped. And when it popped, there was a single herring that was there, just snapped in half. And so the air had come from its air bladder, and then the bubble popped and revealed it was just a single dead herring, snapped in half. And then I just, my curiosity just got me. So then I just took a drop down to exactly where that bubble came from. And I dove down into the darkness. And then I dove down, I saw this, like, the remainder of the herring school. And now it's a very small, little tight ball of bait fish. And it's like, I swear I could feel like the herring, that ball of herring, like trembling in fear, you know? And I was like, all that was left of them, all just together. And I looked at them as I started to kick up, to go back up for air, a huge bull orca just came up, and together, we just ascended together. And it was massive, you know, like it's dorsal fin looked like it was 3 or 4 feet, and it just came up vertically with me, and we both went up, and then it just snatched that one broken herring and went back down, and that was like the memory of a lifetime, you know. So that was
wow.
And it also shows how quickly things can escalate.
Yeah, I mean, what was going through your mind? I mean, blurs going by you, bait getting eaten, and you weren't touched. It was like you had your own bubble around you just protecting you. Like,
exact. I mean, the blurs going by me was the most chaotic, terrifying part, because you just can't even see what's happening. Yeah. And you know that they're hunting, and you're in the middle of them hunting, and you don't feel like this is where you're supposed to be. But it's adrenaline, it's a lot of action, and it's hard not to be in awe of that at the same time as you're terrified of what's gonna happen. And then when everything just went dead quiet and all you see is scales, but where are the whales, you know, where are the orcas? That was probably even more scary, because it's like, what? Like, where are they? Where'd they go? And then it was just pure, definite like, intimidation when you see a big bull orca and you're underwater swimming up for air, which you have to go get air, and it's coming up at you, or, and you think, you know, it's coming up towards you, and that's scary. You're like, uh-oh, did I enter this territory and offend this huge bull? But then when it did just end up swimming up parallel to me, then there was nothing but just like awe and like, oh my God, like this is amazing. And then right. It was just pure admiration when it just went and grabbed that one single herring and went back down. And apparently that is also what they do, is they move so fast that they're thrashing through the herring and pretty much snapping them and breaking them. And then they just go pick them up and eat them one by one. You know, they're not like just opening their mouths and trying to chomp the whole bait ball like you might think they would.
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
precise, and they're using their speed, their sheer speed alone, to just like whack these herrings and just break them like pencils. And then they just selectively eat them one by one, which I didn't know until that moment.
That's interesting. Is that like the craziest moment you've had on the water, or do you have any other like crazy experiences like that?
I mean, I would say, you know, having an interaction with a great white shark.
Was that while you were spearfishing, or was that just like?
No, that was also, that was another just like expedition with biologists and whatnot. And everybody was kind of on scuba in a cage observing, there to observe great white sharks. But on this one certain day, there was just no great white sharks anywhere. People were like falling asleep on scuba. It was getting very, very boring. And I had just asked the captain and expedition leader if I could just, you know, jump in and free dive if there weren't any sharks around. Because I missed free diving and I didn't want to just sit in a cage all day and there's nothing to see anyway. And then of course, as soon as I slipped in the water and my mask started to leak and I was trying to fix it, And my friend was there next to me, just started shaking my arm. And I knew, like, oh God, you know what you're going to see. And as soon as I put my head in the water, there was the biggest great white I ever saw. And it was like 3 feet away from me, coming towards me. You know, it wanted to swim me on the surface. And everyone on the boat could see, and they were screaming. And then I just swam towards her, and then she just turned. And as soon as she turned, I could just see how big she was, but I also could see how slow she started to swim, and how her fins were more parallel and not tucked under, and how she wasn't acting aggressive. She was acting like a very calm shark, but it was still nonetheless, like, you know, crazy. And then she kind of went down and started circling the shark cage, and everybody that was on scuba started freaking out and paying attention. But then after circling them, she would also come back up to me on the surface, and she was swimming calm and slow. But no matter what, when you see a great white swimming vertically up at you, it is an unnerving feeling for sure. And and that part just always, like, freaked me out. But I just knew, like, okay, I'm not gonna try and race back to the boat and act like bait, you know, and I'm not just gonna lay here. So every time she did that, I would dive down and I'd meet her halfway, and it kind of felt like a game of chicken. But every single time she would just turn and then do her own thing, and then I'd kick back up to the surface and she'd come back and do it again. We did it over and over again. And then this one time, when I was swimming down to her and she was swimming up, and she just leveled off and started swimming so slowly, and I hit this point of negative buoyancy, and I was just like falling down towards her. And I had to realize, like, you have two choices right now. You can either turn around and kick your way up, which doesn't sound like the best thing to do. There's a great white shark below you, or you're gonna land on this shark. And the next thought that went through my head was just make it smooth. And so I just kind of like reached out my hand, let her know I was there, and just went for a little swim with her. And we did that a few times. And so that was, you know, and yeah, that was probably one of the most insane moments I had underwater.
You were hanging out with a great white shark and you guys were just swimming together.
Yeah. Wow. Right. And I still, you know, I still feel nervous when I see really big tigers and intimidating sharks for sure. Yeah. But usually you can just kind of read them and understand how to assess the situation. And in that moment, like, that worked out really well.
In front of me, I have the Flushmaster by Seamule. This little device simplifies the process for flushing your engines. All it takes is 3 easy steps. Plug the hose into the device, plug the hoses from the device into your motors, and press on. That's all it takes to preserve the longevity of your motors, ensuring 100% clean water is running through them. So if you want to preserve your motors, go to Seamule.com and go pick up a Flushmaster. What inspires you to have these types of interactions? Was it someone growing up? Like, I know you talked about your dad, but was it him? Did you have a figure or something that kind of, you know, pushes you till this day to be the best that you can? Because now you're an inspiration to a lot of men and women in the spearfishing world. And, you know, it's kind of crazy to hear these stories that you're saying and these amazing accomplishments that you've done. And you're an inspiration, but who inspires you, if anybody?
I mean, definitely my dad was my first inspiration. He's the one who introduced me to this awesome world and just how cool and how magical it is. He's the one that taught me at a very young age, even just when teaching me how to swim, that it all comes down to relaxing, especially when you're scared, is to finding a way to stay calm and choose relaxation instead of panic. He's the one that taught me that. And so I feel like that's, you know, he definitely is a huge inspiration, that just that foundation alone that he's given me has helped me so much. But I would also say this woman named Rel Sun, who was a famous professional surfer in Hawaii. She unfortunately passed away of breast cancer at a young age, but she was a very, very graceful, beautiful surfer. But she was also such a such a badass at spearfishing and freediving, providing for, you know, her daughter is a single mom, and providing for herself. Like, there's just something about that that really, something about just that self-sufficiency that really inspired me. And I don't really see it as a way of, oh, I'm self-sufficient so I can just count on myself. I see it as a way of connecting with the natural world, connecting with the environment, understanding like how to feed yourself from it. And then it makes you so much more than yourself, because it actually makes you a part of a community, because then you have this resource, this harvest, you know, to share with people, and it makes you more useful to your neighbors, your children, your friends, and it gives everybody a little taste of the natural world and what a beautiful place it is, and, you know, delicious food that actually has like real wild stories that come with it. I think that's part of our human DNA. And so to be able to, you know, to go out and get that is amazing. And I think to see, you know, as a young girl, to see a woman doing that really made me understand, like, it's possible, you know, I can do this too. And so she was a huge inspiration.
That's awesome. So now that you kind of, you know, are basically her for a lot of these women and girls that are growing up or doing this now, do you think that currently in the industry, in spearfishing and fishing, that there's a tough stigma with being female? And, you know, obviously, personally, my opinion is you kick a bunch of the guys' asses when you're fishing, clearly, from what I see on socials. And, you know, you're one of the greats in this, especially, you know, as a woman. You, Valentin Thomas, is up there. You know, there's a bunch of people. But how do you combat, you know, the stigma and the boys' club that's around this, and, you know, just keep pushing forward?
Yeah, I think I'm super lucky that I've never really felt I've had to have any like combat with it, which is interesting, you know. And I'm sure I'm probably overlooking some things, but I guess for me, it's not like I didn't have to earn it, or I didn't. After that first day of, you know, going out and getting my own food, that's because nobody else would take me. That's because every single time I saw, like, you know, tried to make friends with somebody who went spearfishing and asked them if I could tag along, they'd always like be nice to my face and say yes, but nobody ever called, you know. And you know, maybe that's because I was a girl and they didn't take me seriously, but I guess I don't take that personal, because it also is like, maybe it's because all my resume was, oh, I used to dive when I was 5. Can I come? And it's like, you know, I was probably a liability to them. And maybe if I was a guy, those doors would have opened sooner. People might have taken me seriously sooner. But I don't really take it personally, because I wanted it bad enough that I just went out and did it. And then when I started showing up at those same barbecues with my own fish, then every single one of those boys started calling, you yeah. know, and everybody started saying, you know, okay, let's take you diving. And there's, I think I enjoy having to earn it. And maybe there are ways where I had to perhaps, you know, prove myself first in order to be taken seriously. But I'm also sure there's a lot of privilege that comes with being a girl too. And I just think that no matter what, I think what I love about diving is that when I put my wetsuit on, put my hood on, put whatever on, it's like, I don't know, I'm not really going diving to be better than the boys, and I'm not going diving to be good for a girl. Like, I just want to be a fucking diver. And I think that if that's genuinely where you're coming from, if that's genuinely what your passion is made out of, the true blues, the real guys, the ones that, you know, the truly great divers, that's all they're going to see when they look at you. That's all they're going to recognize, that, and they're going to treat you accordingly. Will there always be assholes? Of course, you know, will there always be people who maybe don't take you seriously or whatever? Of course. Do I want to die with any of those people? No, you know? And so I just kind of think like, I try not to really care too much about what other people think. And I focus more on my own values and passions. And then that only leads me to people who I look up to so much. And for me in my path, like, I've been so fortunate where those exact people have taken me under their wings. Those exact people have mentored me and taught me things. And so because of that, I can't say that I've had to combat anything. And I probably have, and I'm just not focusing on it. Yeah. But I just feel like, oh my God, I'm so lucky. Like the guys that taught me, because that is just my truth, is that I was, you know, I was taught this all by men. Definitely had a female inspiration who I wish I could have met in real life. And she helped me just from being her and helped me tune into me. But the guys who all took me under their wings and helped me, I just feel like the luckiest person in the world. And so I don't feel like I've had to really fight any stereotypes, or at least none that matter to me.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot of stereotypes put on me that I'm just not even on my radar. And that's fine, you know? But I will say that, when I try to explain this to my sister, she points out to me, that there is a difference between men and women, and there is a difference between opportunity. And she, when I tell her the same thing of how, you know, well, all these guys just helped me out so much and were such great friends to me, and they've always just treated me like a fellow diver. They've never treated me like a princess or less than or anything, you know? But she always says, like, Kimmy, but that's because, you know, you were a natural in the water. Whether you know that or not, you were a natural hunter from the moment they met you. And she said, and do you know why that is? I said, why? She said, that's because Dad, like, didn't raise you any different, didn't raise us any different than he would have sons. And that's because from the moment you were 4 years old, 5 years old, you were invited to go in the water with your dad. You never, and we're kind of like lived in the boonies. We didn't have a lot of society around us. So she's like, you never had these boundaries of boy versus girl, man versus woman put on you, because your dad raised you the way majority of dads would only treat their sons. Your dad gave you this confidence. Your dad gave you this invitation to come with him. And she's like, whether or not you know it, even as a 24-year-old girl, that's the woman, that's the reason why you were able to grab that spear and go by yourself, because of those memories. As a 24-year-old after that, that's the reason why when you got in the water with the boys, you held your presence like that. You had your passion undeterred by the fact of being a woman. It's because at a very young age, you were never treated any different. And then she said, that's not the story for most girls. So you need to understand that. And she said, think about it. Do you remember any other dad, or, you know, at the time, like uncle, any elder who took their daughters diving? And I thought about it. I'm like, no, you're right. Like, it was only boys. Like, I never even thought about that, you know? And she's like, yeah. Like, and she's like, so if you were raised totally differently and didn't have that same opportunity, it definitely would shape you differently. And I think you would view it differently. Mm-hmm. And so that's always been an eye-opening thing for me to hear, and not like I have any total like conclusions from that, but there's so much truth in those points that she makes. And all I can say is, if there's one thing that my presence in this industry has done that I am most proud of, is I can't tell you how many guys come up to me and say, oh, because of you, I take my daughter diving. Yeah. And like, oh, you know, like, you know, I'm inspired by you, and I have a daughter, and I'm getting her into diving. And when they say that, like, now after my sister's little educational lecture, I'm just like, that is the best gift you can give me.
Yeah,
your daughter diving too, not just your son, you know?
You're changing it. You're changing the societal norms for, you know, our sport, for the future generations to come, which is incredible to see. I mean, you've been on the national stage, the world stage, you know, and you have many, many accolades that you've accomplished. And, you know, you've been on TV, you've been on the news, you've been all over the place. And it's inspiring to see, like you said, like, when I have a daughter, God willing, one day, I want to take her diving. I want to treat her like one of the boys, and I want her to go and forage. And, you know, I think that's always the goal for people, or at least my generation coming up now. And you've kind of been able to shape that, which is incredible to see. It kind of leads me into the next question that I have for you is, where do you see the sport going? You know, I feel fishing has, with rod and reel, has developed to now, you know, there's these tournaments, high money, big prize money tournaments. There's, you know, a lot of money poured into it. But I feel as if the spearfishing community and the spearfishing sport is still rooted in, you know, more of a humble, I don't know if that's the right word. If you go to someone that spearfishes and you guys instantly connect, right? Which is pretty incredible. So where do you see the sport going? Where do you see the exposure of it? And, you know, what's your opinion about all that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't totally know. And I would say that that for so many of us, I think humble is the perfect word to use. And I know that would be a blanket statement to put on an entire community or, you know, or sport. But for the most part, like, I love the spearfishing community. Like, I just love them. And of course, there's always going to be, you know, different people, different groups, and everyone's going to be a little different. And I'm sure not everyone's humble, and I'm sure they're super cocky. You know, I get it. But for the most part, I think that the true blues of the true core of this community are the most humble badasses ever. And I love it that way. And so I don't know for sure if it ever will turn into like this, you know, big money thing, you know, maybe, I think it also, it's like not much of a spectator sport. So that's probably an issue too. But for the most part, I mean, maybe they can be to some like big blue water tournaments, with some big cash prizes, who knows, perhaps. But I think for the most part, it really has been going in a way of sustainability. It really has been moving in a way of connecting to ecosystems, and how beautifully selective it is, you know, to harvest in this way. Like, I just think that there's something about spearfishing. There's something about the fact that you have to literally enter another world to do it. Literally go somewhere where you don't get to speak your language, because there's no talking underwater. You know, everything is now body language. Like, if you're trying to bring a fish in or do whatever, but there's no communication with you know, verbally. And you don't even get to breathe. It's like so many things are stripped from you because you have to enter this entirely different like universe. And then you have to like take your body through like all of this like changes, you know, in order to like get where you're trying to go, all for the sake of then pulling the trigger, which is only going to get you one fish. It's to me, there's something about doing it that way that takes a special type of person. And I think maybe that's why, I mean, I know it is a sport. I know it can be super competitive and all of that, but I think for most of us, there's a deeper reason to why we do it this way. And I think that's why there's a lot of people who seem to be so humble about it, because you just do the talking in the water, you know, by your ability, by how you move. And I just think there's something about that that's really special. And I do think that where things are going, it just seems like it's going more and more towards selective sustainability, and the fact that we are perfectly equipped to do that. I think like back in my dad's days, it was about how many fish you could shoot and like spread out in your driveway and take a picture of this like mass, you know, slaughter that you did. I mean, granted, then you take that and you feed a whole community, but I think there was very little regard to the thought of taking too much. But I think these days, spearfishers are some of the most like biggest conservationists I know, because it draws certain people who just know like, number one, I'm a part of this ecosystem. Like I'm a part of this natural world. Like I get to go out and hunt and have all this fun, but I'm doing it in such a selective way that, and then, I think most people who are doing it are simply doing it for food too, for fun and for food. And so I think you put those two things together and it just creates the reward of satisfaction that to me far outweighs the awards of like accolades. And yeah, I mean, money's always nice, but you kind of like can't put a price on that feeling.
Yeah. So no, that makes total sense. You know, being down there hunting and being selective is really the conservation aspect is really the most important thing. And it's almost analogous to hunting on land, where you pick what deer you're going to shoot or what bird you want to kill, what turkey or whatever it is that you're doing. You know, it's almost more analogous to that than fishing by rod and reel, which is kind of crazy. But speaking of being selective, you know, if you had to go pick a fish tomorrow to go harvest, what's your fish that you're going to go after?
I mean, if I could pick any fish, this would change on a daily basis, just so you know. I don't have it's all about whatever I'm craving on a certain day. And I think I've just been like reminiscing so much about dogtooth tunas lately, just having conversations about them. And that if I were to just choose one fish to go get tomorrow, it would be a big old dogtooth tuna, a big old doggy.
Have you shot one before?
I've shot several before, yeah. And they're just such crazy fish. They just really entice me. I just think they're so cool looking. Like they're like ahis with these crazy teeth. And but they're totally different than ahis in the way that they act. And they're like this love child between a tuna and a giant trevally in the way that they fight, where they sound with all the strength in the world, but they also aren't afraid to just run into reef and wrap themselves in reef. And they're just gnarly looking, and they're absolutely delicious. Yeah, they're just such a cool, cool, cool fish.
Where'd you shoot yours when you were hunting them?
I've shot doggies in Africa. I've shot them in Papua New Guinea. I've shot them in French Polynesia.
Wow. What was your largest?
I think my largest one was about 70 pounds.
Okay. That's a big fish. Jeez.
It's a big fish, but they get a lot bigger.
Yeah.
When I shot that one and I was pulling it up, I swear this group of doggies followed my fish up and they're close to 200 pounds.
Wow.
My friend went down to try and shoot one and missed it.
Oh, no. Let's talk a little bit about the gear, right? What is your, do you have a go-to, you know, blue water gun versus a go-to reef gun? And, you know, what is your preference on what you carry out there and, you know, your preparation, mental preparation, and what it takes to be efficient out on the water?
Yeah. Well, I've been sponsored by the company Rife for about 13 years now. And so all of my guns are made in California at Rife International. And so the main one that I use, and they always get on my case because I never ask for a lot of gear. And they're like, Kimmy, you need to keep getting new gear. But I just kind of get like my old faithfuls and I just stick with them. But I would say the 130 Euro Rife is my all around gun. And it's kind of long for most people to like, you know, use on smaller fish or whatnot, but I just find it so handy because I can be, you know, reef hunting for dinner for a moo or uku or, you know, or other fish with it. But at the same time, if an ono, if a wahoo, you know, or a mahi come in, like it's a really great gun to use on the fly for being surprised by a pelagic when you're doing deeper reef stuff. So I would say right. That's like my 130 is like my deeper reef gun, but it's also landed me a good amount of pelagic fish. But if I am going for like big fish, like, you know, yellowfin tuna and stuff, or really big wahoo, I've always used this huge gun. It's totally, you know, not available at Rife International anymore. It's considered pretty outdated, but it was called the Blue Water Express, and it's like this big Bertha. It's like a huge log of a gun. And even like 7 years ago when I was going on dive trips, all my friends would kind of tease me because it's like everyone has these like streamlined, smaller, like roller gun, powerful but slim, and I would always be getting this huge log of a gun out, but I have shot all my best fish with that gun, and it has never ever let me down. And this year I am going to go for innovation, and Rife has like a whole new blue water line out. They have this gun called the Raider, and it just has been it just apparently is the most awesome thing ever. And so right after I hang up from this podcast, I'm getting on a phone call with Rife International because I do have a dive trip to Mexico coming up, and I'm hoping to see big fish there. And I think I'm going to leave Big Bertha at home and have them send me a Raider. So that's going to be hopefully my new blue water gun of choice.
That's going to be awesome. How many bands does Big Bertha have? Is it a roller or...
I would put five, and I'm going to, it's not a roller, but I would put five bands on it, and I'm going to put five bands on my Raider as well. But okay. The Raider is just going to be much more streamlined and hydrodynamic.
Okay. I gotcha. So is there any fish that you are still haven't gotten yet that's been eluding you that you really, really want to target?
Oh, yeah. White sea bass in California, believe it or not, but I've never gotten one of those. I haven't done a ton of diving in California. I almost don't think it's like fair to just show up for 5 days and just expect anything. But nonetheless, I keep doing that and I'll show up for 5 days and I will put all of my time in on the ocean and I will stay in that kelp from sun up to sundown, waiting for these elusive ghost to appear, and it just hasn't happened. I saw one that I didn't get a shot on. But other than that, it's a fish that has just completely eluded me, and I would love to get one. I would also love to shoot a salmon one day. I think that would be pretty cool to go to Alaska and shoot a salmon.
Are there any fish in your local waters that you haven't gotten yet, or like anything that, next to you that you still go after?
Oh yeah, I mean, I would love to get like a big yellowfin tuna in Hawaii. I've gotten smaller ones out here, like we'll call them shibis, and but nothing, nothing really big. And I've gotten big yellowfin tuna in other places of the world, and that's just been completely, oh, such an epic feeling. Like
I'm
I
sure.
really, I don't know, I just really love. I really love my memories of shooting, really nice big ahi, and that's been so fun. But the idea of landing, of actually having that somehow come together in Hawaii, would be amazing.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I know the ones in Hawaii, for some reason, I feel their sickles are just massive on those big Allisons. Those big tunas are just, it's gorgeous to see. What's your PR for big yellowfin?
My PR,
Yeah. What's the biggest yellowfin? Like the biggest yellowfin, your personal record.
personal record, sorry. It was 165 pounds.
Holy smokes. That's
Yeah.
a big one.
But I've seen much bigger that I didn't do, that I didn't get to pull a trigger on, But yeah, but no, I'm totally grateful for my personal best, which was 165
Where
pounds.
was that?
That was at Ascension Island, which is an island in between South America and Africa. But I also got 135 pound yellowfin tuna in Cabo, and I've shot a bunch in Panama that I just never weighed, but that were also legit tuna.
Yeah. Wow, that's pretty incredible. Ascension Island is one of the places I dream about going to. I heard it's just, they call it Jurassic Park, right? It's like just craziness being over there.
It really is. I mean, at the time, it almost just like it almost like cheating, but it is just, it's very, very, there's opportunities all the time. All the time. Like after I shot that one, I just like pretty much brought tuna up to try and help this 12-year-old I was traveling with shoot one himself, which he ended up doing. And I spent the rest of my time doing that. And after that, we just really didn't need much more fish, And because that's a lot of fish, but there's no reason to keep shooting. But the fish that I saw like in the water every day almost made me wish I didn't pull a trigger on that first one, because there's just so many huge tunas.
That's awesome. I want to get out there one day. Maybe I'll be able to, get there and shoot some fish like you. It would be awesome.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have, that was a long time ago, but I would think it's still pretty amazing.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Kimmy, I really appreciate you taking your time. Hopefully, if we're ever in Hawaii, I'll hit you up. Hopefully, we can go diving sometime. And if you're ever down here in South Florida, we'd love to take you out and, jump around the reef here and do some blue water diving, maybe go over to the Bahamas. But it's a pleasure to meet you virtually, and thank you for your time, and I appreciate it all.
Awesome. I would absolutely love that. I did get to do another trip to the Bahamas just a couple months ago. I went last year with Steve Brunella for this episode of Spearfish that I did on YouTube. But he had so much fun that he actually is making a new meat eater episode out of it for this new season. And that was just one of the most incredible trips ever. It's such a special place. I would totally love to come back and thy Florida, thy Bahamas. It's awesome.
It would be awesome. I'm going to check out that episode. I'm a big meat eater fan, so I'm a little jealous that you got to meet Steve and do all that, but maybe we'll get him on the show sometime.
Yeah, that would be great.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on. And, you know, guys, go check out Kimmy. Check out all her stuff. Go watch Meat Eater and check out the episode where she's spearfishing. See you later, guys.
Thanks for joining us on CCO's The Science of Fishing. We hope that this episode was helpful and you learned something for the next time you're wetting a line. Before we cast off, a special thanks to our sponsors, Sea Mule and Black Reef Co. Stay hooked by following us on social media at Science of Fishing and hitting the subscribe button. And if you know someone who'd enjoy this, don't hesitate to share. Until we meet again, catch 'em up.